ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, Anthony Burke here, host of By Design, and this is not our usual episode.
Peter Martin here, host of The Economy Stupid, and we're recording this early Wednesday morning, the morning after the federal budget.
Because something pretty significant happened overnight on housing.
In an era where people feel like the system no longer works for them, this budget doesn't just acknowledge that, it acts on it. By levelling the playing field for first home buyers and renewing that fundamental bargain between generations to help bring the dream of home ownership within reach of more young Australians.
Yes, the government has done it. It's gone after the tax arrangements that have helped shape housing for the best part of three decades, the cut rate capital gains tax turbocharged by negative gearing. That arrangement has pushed up prices, pushed investors into the market, and made owning while occupying more difficult.
And it's meant that for a lot of Australians, especially younger Australians, the dream of just owning one home to live in, well, that dream has been vanishing.
So the question now is, will the budget change anything?
Will it make homes cheaper?
Will it push rents down or up?
Will it change what gets built?
Or even the way we think about housing?
In this special emergency pod for ABC Radio National, Peter and I are going to unpack what changed last night, what it means, and what happens next.
In plain English.
So let's get into it. Peter, great to be talking with you. Now, look, you've watched budgets for a long time as both an economist and a journalist. Did this one feel different?
Oh, yes. The most significant budget was the first one I covered in 85. And that was the budget that introduced capital gains tax.
Can you just give us a kind of a quick primer? You know, what is capital gains tax here?
Well, it's simple. It's a tax on a profit you make by buying something at one price. Could be a piece of art. It could be anything, but it's nearly always housing. Way more than 90% of capital gains are made in housing. You buy it at one price, you sell it at another. We didn't used to tax it until 1985. Then we taxed it at a special rate where you got the inflation component was taken off. In 1999, the Howard government changed that and they said only half of each capital gain will be taxed. A lot of things flowed from that.
So there are a lot of promises from the government coming into this budget. We are going to sort of fix the intergenerational wealth issue. We're going to change the housing landscape for Australia. The Australian dream is back on the table. Do you kind of get that sense of big promises being made here? And people are kind of taking them on with a bit of optimism, perhaps?
I think they're right. Robert Menzies was Prime Minister of Australia for an awfully long time. The government he led for most of that time, the coalition government, was in power for 23 years. Now, he basically is responsible for Australia's high rate of home ownership. Mm. From the end of the Menzies era right through to 1999, you had about 70% of the homes were owned by the people who lived in them.
Yeah.
Only the other 30% were landlords, and a fair chunk of them, actually, about 6%, 7%, was public housing. So we were a nation where owning a home was something you expected to be able to do. And
yeah.
By the way, then you could actually pay it off fairly quickly. That changed almost instantly in a matter of years. It fell to 67%. That's where it is now from 70%. That is quite a fall. Among the sort of young, the people who used to get into home ownership early, that's 30 to 34-year-olds, home ownership has fallen from two-thirds to a half. So
yeah.
It was a very big fall.
Big
now, you're about to ask me what the government did. That is, I said they returned. I said, Anthony, they returned to how things used to be, but it's not quite that. It's even, and this is a surprise in the budget, it's even more extreme than how things used to be.
So it's not exactly back to the future, but it
not
is
exactly
a looking backwards in order to go forwards in a certain sort of way. So how did the measures that we heard about last night change things?
They've said, yeah, we'll go back to the old system with something extra. You will pay, no matter what the inflation calculation, you will pay a minimum 30% of the increase in value. And the reason they've done that, and they explain in the budget papers, a lot of people are very sneaky with their timing, these landlords. What they would do, they would say, oh, yeah, well, we've got this capital gains tax discount, right? We're only taxed on at our tax rate of half the gain we made. But then they'd wait until their tax rate was about zero, till they retired. So, right. So what Jim Chalmers has said, and we didn't expect this, I'm on to you.
Yeah.
Okay, you may have retired. Well and good. You've still got to pay a minimum of 30%. The overwhelming bulk, 80%, 80 to 90% of investors who dive into the market do elbow out renters, so they create their own market, if you like. Only 10 to 20% of them actually build or buy new houses. The treasurer has said, look, if you're building or buying a new house, if you're adding to supply, everyone talks about supply. You can keep the old arrangements.
Yeah.
No problem. You can have the 50% discount. No problem.
So this is the grandfathering in clause, isn't it? Like if you're in that situation right now, nothing's going to change. You're all good. But if you want to go into investment in the future, it's a different landscape. Something you're going to have to sort of approach that with a different kind of set of ideas, I guess.
And it's also withdrawing negative gearing unless you actually build or buy a brand new house.
Now, that's interesting, right? So, I mean, I'm very curious what you think about that, because it does seem to kind of now divide the housing market into existing and new. And we've got all this housing stock out there, which we're trying to activate, but this seems to put the bias in one direction.
Well, it'll be a bit hard to enforce, and I'm a great fan of what the Treasurer's done in the broad, but what's a new house, Anthony?
That's a great question. Exactly. I mean, is an adaptive reuse a new project or an old one?
This hasn't really been worked out, and there's very little in the budget papers that talks about how they define that.
Yeah, this is the devil in the detail to come, to be sort of washed out. And I do feel, a bit like you, I think in general it's been actually a really positive, almost, dare I say it, optimistic kind of approach to this massive kind of national conversation that we're having around housing, cost of living and all the rest of it. So I suppose, though, that detail will wash out. But right now, essentially, those reforms are about nudging out investors out of the market, higher taxes, with higher taxes, making more homes available is the goal. Do you think more homes will actually become available?
The government says 75,000. Now, I did calculations based on the rate of owner occupying that we used to have, and I got about 300,000 if we got back to that. They think we'll get halfway there.
Yeah.
They think we will undo 10 years of the shift toward landlords owning houses instead of owner occupiers, and they say that the last 10 years has seen a shift of 75,000.
Yeah.
A lot of critics, immediately, like last night, just after the budget, have said, oh, it's not going to cut home prices much. And this is true, according to the Treasury forecast. Home price growth will be 2% lower in the next year, in the first year this is in place, and then another 2% lower in the following year. It had been thought that this would have a big effect. The former Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull, 10 years ago, when Bill Shorten put this forward, he said it would smash home prices. So the Treasury doesn't think it will do that, but see, it doesn't need to. If you think the problem is that we don't own homes, that we've been increasingly returning to the what we used to be, which before Menzies, which was a nation of renters and landlords. If you think that is the problem, and you get investors out of the way, they're going to have to sell to someone. So of course they're going to sell to people who would own the homes to live in them. That's definitional. That will lower the price a bit, but it won't need to lower it much for those renters who will be desperate to buy to come in.
Yeah.
That's why they don't think there will be that much change. And some people have been saying, you know, just last night, this isn't going to make much difference to the house prices. How will this fix intergenerational problems? It won't in that way.
Yeah.
But it will by making the 30-somethings be perhaps more like the situation we used to have where two-thirds of them could buy houses.
Yeah.
And at the moment, it's a half, Anthony.
So, look, but we've been here before, as you said, you know, Keating in 85 as the Treasurer. He then got rid of negative gearing back then. And then 2 years later, Hawke comes in and buckled under pressure from the property industry and it was back on the table. What do you reckon? Do you think this is going to stick?
There was a really big scare campaign.
Yeah.
So
I can smell one of those coming already, can't you?
I don't know. I think it's been left a bit late. This has been telegraphed since the beginning of the year,
yeah.
And a scare campaign hasn't got ahead of steam.
Mm.
What actually happened to rents was not much, but it was said they climbed. Now, the government has a forecast for rents. The government says that this will push up rents. Now, in theory, it shouldn't make much difference because you're taking the supply of rental properties, you're reducing that, but you're reducing it because you're also reducing the number of people who will want to rent because they're buying those properties.
Yeah.
Often it'll be the same person. I mean, literally, what we are going to now see is people buying from their landlords. I mean, there will be cases of that. So that shouldn't change the supply and demand for rents. But the government makes the point, the Treasury makes the point that even a small drop in the price of homes will make building homes less profitable. You cut the price of oranges, people are less likely to grow oranges.
Yeah.
So that they think will mean there'll be 35,000 fewer homes over a number of years. Now that's tiny, by the way, in proportion.
In real terms, yeah.
in proportion to the 10 million homes we have, they think that effect will push up rents by $2.
Yeah.
I don't know what rent you've been paying in your life. I know what rents I were paying, have been paying, and I don't know if $2 is much of a move.
Yeah, look, I think what you just said there, like, you know, the mechanics here are sort of marginal, but the conversation is changing. And I think that's a big part of what this budget really represents. The narrative is kind of moving in a new direction, and it's being committed to in a way that we've never seen, well, we haven't seen for the last few decades. So that's something really impressive that's come out of this particular moment. So you're listening to a special budget podcast with me, Anthony Burke, host of By Design.
And me, Peter Martin, host of The Economy Stupid.
So Peter, let's move on for a second here and talk about the critics who are often arguing that these kinds of tax reforms that we're hearing about are going to end up hurting renters, as you've been talking about. I kind of wonder, as you're saying, it sort of sounds like it's a nil-sum game, really. Renters come out, or they're a little more disadvantaged, but actually there are more people going into their own homes, so the amount of renters is diminishing as the new homeowners is rising.
Look, the best way you can help renters is to make sure they're no longer renting. I mean, it was Tony Abbott, bless him, the former Prime Minister, and he got in a lot of trouble for penning this line. He wrote the line for John Hewson, the former opposition leader. He was working for the opposition leader, and he said that you can always tell a house where the houses are rented because the gardens aren't well looked after. and there's a reason, and there's a reason why that hit home.
Mm.
Renters aren't going to look after the gardens. They are not going to even feel confident to, you know, put a nail in a wall.
Yep.
To hang up paintings. I'm renting at the moment. I've moved cities, and my wife's an artist. We can't.
You can't hang the work.
No. Oh, I suppose. And then we could. Plaster over it, you know, for the quarterly inspection.
What you mean. You can't settle in. You can't feel like it's a place to really bed in, and that's got consequences.
Yeah. Now, other countries have 30 years renting, and it's completely different. The government wants to move. It's got other measures in previous budgets to move towards this, to make build to rent easier. Now, these are apartments. These are not houses. A lot of people don't want to live in apartments. But, see, if you are a mum or a dad, okay, and you've put unwisely, but because of the tax system, you're putting all your eggs in one basket, you've bought the rental property. You might have bought two. That's where all of your money is. So, of course, you're worried about people banging nails into walls. You're terrified.
Yeah.
And that's why you have these intrusive inspections all of the time. But if you are a corporation and you own a block of 100 units, you don't care what someone does. You're just like an insurance company. You say, okay, two of these apartments are going to get treated badly. We'll have to pay to fix them up. That's the cost of doing business. It would be no point in inspecting. A huge point for us in saving money. Someone can live in it for 30 years, do what they like, treat it like a homeowner, right?
Yep.
Actually
feel
care,
that ownership,
actually
that care
for it. Mm, mm. That's what happens in the US. That's what happens in Europe. It doesn't happen here, and I'm not sort of saying it should, because Australians, you know, in my view, I like freestanding houses. Australians are a nation of freestanding houses. But if we move more toward that and away from, you know, what we've come to expect, which is that a good number of houses in every street are owned by landlords, and those poor landlords are paranoid, really, about what will happen to the house.
Yeah. Let's talk about public housing. And look, I did see Alan Collar the other day saying, why don't we just build some public housing? You know, we haven't done that for a while. If the government wants to fix housing, let's just build some.
Yeah, it's harder than you would think, just because the building industry bizarrely chugs along at a certain rate. And the government has found this with its targets, you know, for building a million or so new houses, that it just can't keep pace because the building industry can't keep pace. But we have at the moment rent assistance, Commonwealth rent assistance. Mm-hmm. You can't get it if you're not on a benefit. So you can be really poor and not get Commonwealth rent assistance. It goes nowhere near the supporting the actual rents. In fact, the government's increased it quite a lot. It's had two increases. And the bizarre thing is, if you look at the numbers that are associated with each of those increases, they say, well, for someone on the maximum, and almost everyone gets the maximum, because rents are now just so expensive. So, yeah, that would help. I think tell me what you think about this.
Yeah, look, no, I sort of think actually this is something worth, this is a part of that conversation we really do need to open up again. It's been decades since we've had a serious conversation about public housing and what that might look like. And at the moment, we're about 3% of the housing stock is public housing, which is historically minuscule. Like, we have had much, much larger percentages of the housing stock in public housing in the past, and it hasn't done us bad. In fact, it's given us that kind of safety net that we're talking about. And I do think there's something to be said for that little bit more of intervention there. And I'm saying this because I'm seeing this happening around the world. I'm thinking specifically now of Denmark. I'm thinking of some of the things that the Finns have done in Scandinavia. Of course, Singapore is a model you mentioned earlier on. So there are models here that don't have to be massively interventionist, but actually where the government coming in and sort of providing that housing underneath through the public housing system is something that can be kind of reimagined, I think. Again, I think this conversation, the budget's opening up, allows for us to have that seriously from this point on. I want to ask you a question about supply, because I know that's something you've got some strong opinions about. And this is what we
you
hear
might
everywhere.
Too.
I certainly do as well. But I mean, the idea that supply, it's all about supply and demand. You know, it's not, I don't think it's just about supply myself. I think, you know, we've got over a million empty homes standing in Australia every night. As you were saying before, rental properties or investment properties that are simply empty because they're appreciating faster than managing the rent would sort of want you to do. So do you think that this whole conversation that's been framed around supply and demand, or the supply in this way, do you think that's kind of old news, or do you think there's somehow that's starting to fray?
I think what's really pushed up prices has been the influx of investors buying existing properties.
Yeah.
But that's having said that, obviously, if you doubled the number of houses, you would, homes, you'd reduce the prices. But in a way, this has been happening. Mm. So over the past 10 years, Australia's population, everyone says, oh, population's growing. Population has grown 16% over the past 10 years, and that includes those very big years of growth after COVID.
Yeah.
16%. The number of dwellings, the number of houses, homes, has grown 19%.
So more.
We've got the supply. What's been happening within that, and this is really what's been driving our overall shortage, there's also the positional good thing. People want good houses by the water and there's only a limited number. But what's been driving the growth in demand for houses, even though the population hasn't been growing, is houses are emptying.
Yes.
So
that's it.
You got all these new houses.
This is where we agree.
These houses these days, they're mansions compared to the one I grew up in.
Mm.
And they really are.
Absolutely.
They've got more than one toilet. They have things called dining rooms. I don't remember
Imagine.
That. We used to have kitchens. Kitchen without a dining room.
Yeah,
they've got
yeah.
living rooms in addition to the lounge room. So we have houses. We have, one or two people, these are people whose children have left home, rattling around in these houses
in
with
these
several
big
bedrooms.
Empty, mowing the carpet every weekend, spending time maintaining this sort of giant thing that's costing them
a bomb. I'm not saying, by the way, I really hate this idea of appropriate housing for older people. If people want to do that, I think that's fine. Mm. They've lived all of their life. They've worked hard. Yes, they should be able to hang on to their house. But in a way, that and also post-COVID, our desire for an extra bedroom each, so for a home office, it's demand.
Yeah.
If you just look at supply and demand, it's demand for houses that's been growing. Really, that's been driving it rather than a shortage of supply. Yes, it'd be nice to have more houses. Where are we going to put them, Anthony?
Yep. That's a great question, because right now we're putting them on the fringes of the metropolitan centres.
We need a new city.
People way away from where they're working. That's not working out so well for everybody. So what do you do?
Well, a new city would help.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
We did it once.
Yeah.
But we've only done it once.
Yeah. I'm not sure what to say about that.
well, we did it. No. I mean, seriously, we created Canberra out of nothing. That would do it. Urban infill is a terribly good idea. That will help.
Yeah.
Turning two houses into one. But urban infill is one of the things to do. Not everyone likes living in apartments.
Yeah.
Do you?
No. Look, I think
I'm not saying they're a bad thing, but they can be. They can be very small.
No. I think there's two parts to that question. One is, I agree with you entirely that urban infill, there's this great movement in Adelaide, the Bluefields housing, which is that kind of very small, very incremental alts and adds to just increase the density, take it from 1.5 to 1.9 to 2 to 2.5 people on a block. And just doing that incrementally in a very small way that doesn't really affect the character of the neighbourhood. It's a very gentle kind of density upping, if you like, which I think has huge implications around Australia. And I think that's the first thing. The second thing, the apartment thing, I think our reality is that about 16% of Australians live in apartments now. And what will change, or what is changing, is the idea that that's somehow only ever the first step on the rungs, on the ladder to owning your own home. Actually, people are now choosing apartments because they want the amenity of living in a denser area. They want to be near the shopping centre. They don't want to have to get in their car. They want to be near the train stop.
These are retirees, especially.
This is it. Yeah, you're right. But I think it's even young families. They just need to be near people that can help with their everyday life.
And people are living in Melbourne.
Childcare, for example.
In cities. Living in the city of Adelaide, in the city of Melbourne, in a way they never used to.
Yeah. So and that is super attractive. So how do you get to how do you kind of change that idea? If I can live in isolation in a sort of a detached home on the periphery of the metropolitan centre, or I can live with other people in some kind of more connected way, closer to the middle, where everything is around me that I want and need for a good life, that conversation is what's starting to kind of change the idea of the apartment as a whole. And I think what's happening is let's say, the inspired developers, if there's such a thing. The inspired developers out there are recognising this, and they're not just doing investment property housing in the apartment space. They're thinking about them in much longer term, much more generous kind of terms for really a family going into an apartment and having a very good situation there, bigger ceiling heights, more space, more common amenities to share, those types of things. So I think that's a really positive change, but it's a big cultural conversation that's going to take a long time to turn around. So steady as she goes.
I think we can, pack is the wrong word, but we can fit more people into our cities, and we can do it in ways that won't show that much. I'm not sure what the alternative is. The alternative would be, you know, some sort of Stalinist thing where we said to people when their children have left home, you must move to a smaller house. And that's not the kind of nation we are. The other alternative would be to build a new city, and much is how I'd love that.
But I think too, I think what's going on here is we're saying we really need to have more choice available to us. And right now we're kind of we have been locked into a very singular idea of what home in Australia looks like. And now what's starting to happen, I always think this is a generation of change. And that idea of what a home is to this generation coming through, the millennials, the X's, and the Z's, like, they're starting to think, you know what, home for me could be really different to the way that my parents grew up in that kind of home. And I actually kind of like that idea of living closer to my friends or living with my friends. So these are the conversations that are happening at that level, and that's 50% of the population. I think that's really interesting to keep track of. So look, back to one of the questions we started with, Peter. Will this budget, do you think, all things considered, do you think this budget will make homes ultimately more affordable?
I think it will make it easier to own a home. I think whether it makes it more affordable is neither here nor there. Mm. But, I think what really matters for, say, those 30-somethings, what really matters is to be able to buy a home.
Yeah.
Now, you know, I think interest rates will have a lot to do with that and mm-hmm. so on. But people are really willing. The Rudd government had a housing summit right at the beginning. And the key thing that came out of that, I was sitting there, and bless Kevin Rudd, he didn't look at his phone once. He was really paying attention. And the key thing that people there were saying, these are people who sort of provide social housing and variants thereof, is that people will do anything. They will stretch themselves big time.
Yeah.
They will go beyond what you think they could afford if it means owning their home. Owning a home is so important to people. Mm-hmm. I think it'll do that. It's not so much that it will affect the price, and it changes sort of, I was going to say changes the conversation, but that's a lazy way of saying it. It introduces a new norm.
Mm-hmm.
It means that we're now seeing what we should be doing is allowing owner-occupiers, giving them a good chance of owner-occupying, rather than doing our bit to buy a second house, to rent it to someone, by changing what is regarded as normal,
yeah.
I guess by the symbolic effect, and there was a lot of symbolism in the Treasurer's talk.
Yeah, I thought so too, yeah.
That, you know, all of this generational things. I think that's important. And also demographics is on his side. I think there's a reason that Bill Shorten, you know, basically proposed these policies and lost an election first in 2016, then in 2019. Same policies, lost both elections. And things were different then.
Yeah.
Firstly, housing wasn't as hard to get into. It's become increasingly hard. Secondly, the bulk of voters, the big block, were the baby boomers who were perhaps themselves property investors. Now, the bulk of voters are the generations after them, the millennials and so on. But also, I think the views of the boomers themselves have changed, because they're seeing children and grandchildren,
yeah,
who can't get into houses, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think
times have changed.
I agree. And actually, interestingly, I saw in an AFR poll, Albanese's approval ratings going up because of all of this. And you're talking about the voting bloc changing. I think, you know, there's a pretty good sign that maybe they're onto something.
Yeah, and also I think that they've probably changed something. This is beyond the scope of this program in politics, which is they're almost selling breaking a promise not to touch negative gearing.
Yeah.
As a good thing.
Yeah, this we're going to have to take this heat because this is good for all of us.
Yeah, this is doing the right thing,
yeah.
as they say, is more important than keeping a promise. And I guess I'm sort of encouraged.
Yeah.
But I'd rather a government did the right thing than kept the promise myself. Economists like me, Anthony, tend to reduce housing to supply and demand. I talked about oranges. Mm. But you've argued that the situation we're in is actually a cultural crisis. I'm not very good at culture. What do you mean?
Well, look, the way I see it, and I guess this is where I do step away. I mean, I'm definitely not an economist, so I'm going to put that on the table right now. I'm fascinated by this conversation because it does, as you sort of say, open a can of worms here into a much bigger conversation that the nation's been struggling with for a good decade now. But for me, this whole conversation then is, what does a home mean to us in Australia? And we keep throwing back our imaginations to those homes of the 1950s, that idea of the, you know, mum and dad and two kids and all of that kind of stuff, that suburban dream, the Australian dream. We keep hearing that phrase. But of course, we've changed. Our demographics have changed. Our needs have changed. The climate around us has changed. The way we live has fundamentally changed. And yet our housing hasn't. The type of house that we really need hasn't changed at all. So we're kind of 70 years behind, really, when it comes to innovating in the houses that we're building today for the families that are going to live in them today. Just to give you an example, only 42% of Australians live in what we'd call a nuclear family. So we've got, you know, ballpark 60% of Australia who live in some other family arrangement, single parents, mixed or blended families, all these kinds of things. And the houses that we've been building do not really sort of think about that kind of situation in the way that they're imagining the future for, you know, for an what is now an average Australian family. So I think that's really interesting. And at that point, you have to sort of start asking, well, you know, do we need to sort of really think of this from a cultural perspective about our expectations of home? I think you mentioned before, we live in really big houses now. We've expected space. You know, we've had all these kinds of ideas. But those things are what we have to change and which are, I think, changing with the millennial conversation coming through. And so at that point, you know, it's a big shift, this cultural conversation. Nothing's going to change overnight. I personally don't think that this budget is going to do a lot to change the affordability equation. But what I do think it has done is it sort of legitimised a new conversation to happen in Australia. And with that in mind, I mean, let 1,000 flowers bloom, right? Let's see all of those different models on the table. That's what I want to see.
You might show us some models on grand designs.
I'd be delighted to. It would be my real pleasure.
But we should mention that by design, the brilliant series on the housing crisis, the home front, you're going to be revisiting that in June. You'll be updating it.
Yeah, look, I'm going to plug your show as well. You know, everyone, tune in to The Economy Stupid as Peter looks at this fierce debate that's raging around the nation. No better place to get your economic news than The Economy Stupid. Well, look, that's it from us now on this special budget episode. I want to just say thank you to the producers, Siobhan Hunt and Sam Carmody. I'm Anthony Burke.
I'm Peter Martin.
And thanks, everyone, for listening.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.